Meeting to order for the Public Finance Advisory Committee Thursday, August 27th. May we have roll call starting from the left, Madam Treasurer?
Here.
Wallace Roedeker, here.
Lisa Hughes, present.
Tom Hammond, present.
Michelle Aguirre, here.
And you're, Ms. Aguirre, you are an alternate member?
Correct, for Frank Kim.
All right. Then at first item on the agenda would be the approval of minutes of the June 18th meeting. Do I hear a motion?
A motion.
A second?
I'll second.
Any questions, comments, additions?
I have a comment.
If I may?
Yes.
I'd just like to, just an update on, we've talked about this already, but I think for the record, would you give us an update on the megahertz deal, what's happened since the last meeting?
Yes, good afternoon, members of the PFAT committee. Suzanne Lester, CEO, Public Finance. At the June 18th committee meeting, the committee approved unanimously the recommendation of Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe as bond counsel for the proposed 800 megahertz finance upgrade financing. The committee did not come to a resolution. There was a 3-3 vote on the selection, recommended selection of bond counsel or disclosure counsel, Squire Patton Boggs, and pursuant to the bylaws, that action failed to carry, and so no action is taken. So since that time, we have we've rejected all bids. We've notified the proposers that the county is rejecting all bids related to the disclosure counsel portion of the proposal. And then we rebid the disclosure counsel portion only as an invitation to bid. So at the invitation to bid, the bids that are received, the recommendation for selection will go to the lowest responsive, responsible bidder. And those bids are due to close tomorrow at 3 p.m. And so we'll look at those bids, determine who the lowest responsive, responsible bidder is, and bring that recommendation to PFAC at the September 10th meeting.
Thank you.
Any further comments?
No.
Thank you for that report. Are the minutes approved? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Hearing no opposition, that brings us to the next item on the agenda, the verbal presentation overview of the proposed bond issuance for Community Facilities District, CFD 2015-1, the Village of Ascentia. By the way, we had a delightful tour for those of us who were there. Yeah. Who will be presenting, Ms. Lester?
Thank you, Chair Hughes. Before I introduce our presenter, I just would like to recap that last month, most of the members of the committee attended a tour of the Rancho Mission Viejo community village of Ascentia in July. And county staff's expectation is to bring the details of the proposed financing to the committee at the September 10th meeting. It's been a long, complex formation process, and now we're at the proposed finance stage. There's a lot of information that goes along with forming a CFD and financing. So we thought we'd provide a preview of the information at the meeting this month to jumpstart the process. So at this time, I'd like to introduce Tom DeMars, our financial advisor on the CFD formation and proposed financing. And Tom DeMars is the managing principal of Fieldman Rolapp and Associates.
Welcome.
Great. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tom DeMars of Fieldman Rolapp and Associates. As Suzanne outlined, we thought we would give you a preview of what's going to be coming to the committee in the next few weeks and to hopefully to the board later in September. So the first thing that we wanted to do is just give you this overview, and a lot of this is going to be covered in more detail in some of the reports that will be coming before you over the next few days. So what we're going to cover today is what's happened so far as the formation is concerned, give you a sense of what the project overview is, what it's financing, the property owner information, and who's all involved in that. The entitlement information that was set out back in 2004 and 2006 by the board, and give you some concluding remarks and also some appendices where give you a little bit of idea on who's been participating as far as the financing team is concerned, the absorption report, some of the appraisal and the overlapping debt that's associated with the county policies, as well as the California Debt Investment Advisory Committee guidelines. So with that, on the CFD formation overview, there's been, and this is all within a sequence within the Mello Roos statute as to how these things are progressively carried about. So March 3rd of this year, the board adopted two resolutions, one for the intention of forming the CFD, and then also one with the intention to incur bond and indebtedness up to about $110 million. Then following that period of time, on April 14th, the board conducted a public hearing. And as a result of that public hearing and no protests at that public hearing, they adopted a resolution to actually form the district at that point and also determined the necessity to incur the bonded indebtedness at the future date of $110 million. The following, a couple of days later, an election was held with the landowners on April 16th. April 21st, the statement of election results was presented to the board, and it was certifying the results of that election, and the board had authorized the filing of the judicial validation of the formation of the district. And just a side note on the validation process, it's been the county's policy with all its community facility districts formations over the years is to always have that validated and go through the judicial validation process. It's not required, but it's been the county practice and policy to do that. On May 5th.
Pardon, may I interrupt?
Sure.
Tell me what the theory of the judicial validation again. Why do you do that?
It's to have the court validate the formation of the special tax and the legality of the special tax and the formation of the CFD for the financing through a judicial process. And the bond council takes care of that in making that filing. And then the board adopted the resolution on May 5th authorizing the levy of that special tax. And on May 12th, the judicial validation of the formation of the district was filed in the Superior Court within the county. And then on July 16th, the court had entered into a default judgment validating the formation of the district.
That's sort of like a process where we certify an election,
or
we're certifying this, so that if the public has an opportunity, if it wanted to file a lawsuit against it, that's my understanding.
Correct,
right?
And there is that appeal period.
Right.
And we've gone past that appeal period
right.
at this point.
So they enter in a judgment and...
If I may ask, you say you entered a default on that, a default judgment?
Just means nobody filed a response against
right. Who would have filed an answer or a response?
The property owners, any citizen, anyone could have.
So anybody could have filed.
Sure.
So in the absence of that, you get your default judgment.
Correct.
Yeah. And Mr. DeMars, on the behalf of the landowners, is there just one landowner in this case?
No. Since the Rancho Mission Viejo was the original landowner of the property, but in the fall of last year, a number of land sales had taken place,
mm-hmm.
and the land was conveyed over to various merchant builders, which we'll cover in a little bit.
Oh, okay, that's right, all right.
Who were also voted on that ballot.
All right, forgot about that.
All you need is somebody who has standing to file an objection, but.
So we've gone through the whole formation process and the adoption of all the resolutions and the validation process. And so what's actually being proposed to be financed as far as the public facilities are concerned are a number of off-site transportation improvements, on-site roads, traffic signals for all the development or the infrastructure associated with the development. Storm drain, water and sewer facilities that Santa Margarita Water District will be a part of. Dry utilities and also the La Pata Road improvements that the county is working on. A number of those include Cow Camp Road, which is part of that, and the bridge that some of us all went over on the tour. The village itself is part of the Rancho Mission Viejo Ranch master development. It's the second phase of their planned community development. There was a prior CFD that was done by the Water District in 13, which is very close. It's right next door to the proposed or the actual CFD now. Located at basically Antonio and Ortega Highway, east of San Juan Capistrano and a little bit south and east of Ladera. There's 12 for sale residential projects, which is about a little over 1,100 units, 840 of those. And then we have 318 units that are for what we call age qualified for the 55 and older. There's a 113 unit apartment complex, affordable apartment complex, and then 150 market rate apartment units. A 1 acre parcel for a proposed daycare center that would be developed in the future. And then the ranch has conveyed about 14 acres over to the Capital Unified School District for use as a K-8 school site.
Chair, I have a quick question, if I might, through the chair. How long is the restriction on the affordable apartment and market rate? I can't remember, is it 50 years, or is that standard, or does it vary based on type?
I don't know. I mean, a lot of the affordable housing agreements that we've seen on prior bond financings say 55 years, but at this point, I don't know if that is a standard requirement or if it's something that's negotiated deal by deal.
Is that something the county sets or like our zoning, or would that be something that's set outside of the county?
I mean, typically our housing authority will approach us.
Okay.
And so I think, you know, they've worked through those, but that's something I can follow up on.
Isn't there a state statutory requirement on affordable housing? Isn't it in compliance with that, Mr. DeMar? Isn't there a state requirement?
I'm not familiar with the Affordable Housing Act.
I thought there was cities had to comply and county had to comply with a certain criteria.
I know there's certain, you know, criteria and certain requirements, and this is only through articles I've read in the paper because I don't have a housing, affordable housing background, but, you know, where I've read where municipalities have requirements and sometimes they choose to pay money rather than write fees.
There is a statutory requirement of some sort.
Yes.
Yeah, I assume meets that criteria. I would assume so.
Can we just have, if it's not a big deal, just a paragraph or two at our next meeting on that? But if it is a huge deal, we'll talk about doing it. There's got to be a county some manual from our fair housing people.
Yes, and I know that the expectation is that the affordable housing component will be developed in around 2017, 2018.
Right, I think what in not just specifically with respect to this financing, but overall, the concern was in some of them in the new developments that should be coming back online, what the requirements are. So we have a general knowledge of that.
Yes.
Can we do that, Ms. Daffrey?
Yes, I believe I have a colleague in my office who
who's, this is their expertise.
Who's the guru in that?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry for the interruption.
No problem.
But we'll give you a copy as well.
Okay, thank you. So here's a map, the boundary map of the CFD, which is outlined in red. And then interesting, the ranch has already made application for the formation of the second CFD as far as the development for the Village of Ascensia. And that's in that upper right-hand portion there with the outside of the red line. So there will be more development that will be coming in the various phases. The master developer, as most of you know, is Rancho Mission Viejo, and it's under their PA2 Development LLC as the master developer, and the members of that are the RMC Community Development Company as the managing member, and then DMB Ladera LLC, who's also a member of that program. And
mm-hmm.
they were also part of the whole Ladera Ranch development as well. The master developer, the ranch, has not abandoned or defaulted on anything that we've been able to come up with over regarding the assessment, any assessments or community facilities districts, or been delinquent on any payments of any taxes or assessments that they've been obligated to pay, and haven't been in default in any of their private development financing.
Tom, if I could interrupt
sure.
for a moment. Chair Hughes, are you
no, it's off.
We've lost our screen.
Okay. Do you have
I hate it when that happens.
You should each have one of these
right.
in front of you, and perhaps
right. so we do. We just can't turn the microphones off.
You can't turn the microphones off. Okay. Perhaps if the sheriff communications officer that's sitting behind us might come to assist us.
Right on cue.
Wow, there are ears everywhere. Just happened to have one of those lying around, huh?
That's pretty spooky.
Oh, really?
I've never seen it do that.
You've never seen it do that?
Okay. We're good.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next
make
slide.
House calls.
Okay. The next slide outlines the number of merchant builders that are participating in the development of the CFD. They're all very familiar names, not only in California, but within Orange County, in developing homes in Irvine, Tustin, Ladera Ranch, et cetera. They're all very familiar folks. And it gives you an idea how many projects that they have for a total of 12. It gives you an idea how many acres are involved and the percentage of acre to owned, as well as the number of units that they're proposing to bid out in each of those individual projects. The entitlement information, the board approved the general plan amendment back in November of 2004, outlining the development agreement for the Village of Ascensia. There were certain terms and conditions and standards of performance that needed to take place upon that approval. And we've learned that all those entitlements with respect to the formation of the district have been completed at this point. So the proposed financing structure is obviously through the Mello-Roos Act and the CFD formation. The bonds will be secured by the special taxes that will be initially levied on the undeveloped property, but then as property does develop, it'll pass on to whoever purchases the property, and mainly it's the residential homeowners. The bonds will be secured by the special taxes that are collected based on the rate and method of apportionment that was adopted as part of the board actions. There will be a debt service reserve fund that will meet the IRS three-prong test of either 10% of the par amount or max annual debt service or 125% of average annual debt service, whichever is the lesser of those three. We have no additional bonds that are going to be issued, although we have $110 million that are authorized that we're probably looking at in the range of 90 to 95 maybe But there will be no additional bonds issued on that, other than for refunding purposes as the district builds out. Within the rate and method of apportionment, we've also included an ability for the ultimate property owner to be able to prepay their special tax if they choose to do that. So that's available, and it's optional based on what the property owner would like to do with regard to the Melrose tax.
Pardon me, is the, did I understand from, will these bonds be drawn down in tranches as they need the money, or will it be one financing, or how do you intend?
It'll be one financing with no additional series after that.
So you'll draw.
We'll close off the lien.
So you'll do 90 or 110 million all at once?
Correct. Correct.
All right.
And most of that, well, actually, all of it is pretty much in the ground already. So it's more of a reimbursement back for those facilities that have been put in the ground now.
If I might ask you to go back to the one chart that right before this, I just had a quick question.
Sure.
I know one of the questions we get a lot is, once the bonds have been issued, we show them online, we track what the outstanding balance is, and we hear from taxpayers that there is an opportunity in some of the bond documents that they could extend the Melrose even after some charges on the tax bill, even after the bonds are paid off. Is that something that's included in this document? Is
no.
it different on each of them? Or once the bonds are paid off, does that actually then satisfy and there will be no more Melrose charges?
There won't be any more Melrose charges, and usually when you have those additional charges that go beyond, it's mm-hmm. for service and maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And typically those are with the school districts
mm-hmm.
that have those type of provisions. But within the counties related to the land development, there isn't that provision in there. So once the bonds are matured, that'll be it.
They would. So it's just on the school district. So thank you. That's helpful because I know we do get some questions.
Yeah.
The other is, you talked about that tax prepayment that's permitted. Is that new, or is that usually in all of the Melrose? Because we don't put anything on the tax bill relating to that. We do have the, you know, we now are sticking, we're now putting, with the auditor controller's help, we're actually putting the, you know, Ladera Ranch, so you can see it's a CFD from Ladera Ranch. It used to say R2 or R3, and it was not very helpful. And then we have the phone number of the, you know, agency who would be responsible. In this case, I'm not sure if we'll use a third party, but we would have the phone number. But of course, people mostly call the county. They don't look at the number. And is the prepayment something we should put on the tax bills, or is that just unique to this one?
Well, it's not unique to this one. There's mm-hmm. been a prepayment option on some of the other county
okay,
CFDs.
Okay, there are.
Uh-huh. However, to be able to put the prepayment on the tax bill, I think would be problematic because it requires a calculation depending on, you know, how much time is left on the bond and what the interest rate is. And so it goes through a number of steps in order to make that calculation. So.
Right, and I wasn't thinking of the amount, just the fact that, you know, I'm not sure where but we have a section where you can click on and get some Melrose. You know, some of them may be able to be prepaid and very general because, of course, each of them is probably different requirements. So prepayments could be on other Melrose,
correct.
Especially those that yep. the county has done. So it's not something new that's just started right now.
No,
and again, it's non-tax deductible, so there's not a lot of incentive for people to prepay because, of course, if they sell, they've then, you know.
Exactly. So if the average life in a home is 5 to 7 years,
right.
Then they've prepaid that whole 30-year bond and they've walked away from the next owner doesn't have to pay it.
Right, and they're looking at comps, and those right. comps, it might be hard to identify that your house really is a lot more valuable because you don't have the Melrose, but it's hard
right.
actually doing that. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, so next steps. There will be a number of, we're in the process of finalizing all the documents. There will be a compliance report that is also part of the documentation, which really takes us through what the county policies are as related to a 3-to-1 value to lien test, a 2% max tax test, yes. and other criteria that are in the county policies. And we've provided a draft so far to Suzanne and her staff to be able to review that and be able to submit that as part of the September 10th meeting for potential approval. So September 10th, we'll come back. We're docketing all of those for Monday, August 31st. So you'll have that and all those documents and plenty of time for the September 10th meeting. Submitting that for your approval at that point in time. The grand opening for the village is of Ascensia is September 20th. And we found out yesterday that there's having a pre-opening on September 19th. And then they've had such a really good response that they're having some pre-qualified folks come through the week before and have private tours of all the model homes and all the different builders for those that have already been pre-qualified for potential purchase. So we'll probably have some update about that information when we come back to you on the 10th. Then we're scheduled to go before the board on September 22nd, providing PFAC moves everything forward on the 10th. And then actual pricing and closing would be the first part of October. We would price the week of October 5th and then close a couple of weeks later. So that's kind of what the next steps are going to be. And then I've included some appendix, some concluding information and some appendices that I'll go over quickly. The ranch has complied with all the county policies as an applicant in order to form a CFD, so all that's been done. The proposed financing is, we'll go into more detail in the policy compliance report, but the two main ones are the effective tax rates range from 1.84 to 2% of the market value, and the valid lien ratio will not exceed, will not go below 3-1. The financing team, again, the documents that will be coming to you are the resolutions of issuance along with the supplement to the resolution. The preliminary official statement that you're familiar with and other financings will be coming before you, along with the continuing disclosure certificate and bond purchase agreement. So some of the additional information that you get an idea on the financing team, we've had Stratton, Yucca, Carlson, Roth as bond counsel. Our firm is the financial advisor, obviously Suzanne and her staff as far as representing the county and the CEO's office. Stiefel Nicholas is the co-manager with Piper Jaffray as the other underwriter. Best and Krieger is their underwriter's counsel. VA Consulting, we did have an engineer's report that was going through all the cost estimates and the facilities associated with the CFD. That's all been submitted and part of the approval process. David Tosick and Associate has been acting as a special tax consultant and Empire Economics as the county's market absorption and price point consultant to make sure that we're in an absorption environment and price points as far as the homes are expected to be. And just as a side note, from the market absorption and the current market, it's anticipated that the build out of those 1,100 units would, or excuse me, 840 units would be by 2018. And then with the daycare center and the other things to follow shortly after that. We've had an independent appraisal done on the property, which was completed July 15th as a date, but as of value of July 1, so we can make sure that we have our value to lien test incorporated. And obviously the ranch, Jalise Millington and Cynthia Tyson has been representing the ranch and throughout the whole process. And here's the estimated absorption schedule. You can kind of go through that at your leisure, but everything is pretty much built out by 2018. The appraisal is about $290 million, and that's what we'll base our bond size on, so it doesn't go below the 3-1 value to lien test. And the appraisal is represented that the projects appear to have the location features and pricing structures for current financing and market conditions. The direct and overlapping debt, there's three components of that. There's municipal water district debt that's a small portion is included, plus Capital Unified School District, some small portions that are associated with the parcels associated with the CFD, and then the Santa Margarita Water District has the larger portions with their improvement districts number 4 and ID 4C, which gives us our total overlapping debt. Our value lien ratio is taking the the appraised value and the overlapping debt that's on the property right now and what's proposed to be on the property through the CFD in order to get our 3-to-1 value lien test. Again, the estimated tax burden is somewhere between 1.84 and 2%, depending on the unit and the project, which is in compliance with the county's policy test as well as the California Debt Investment Advisory Committee guidelines. And special taxes have been levied for 2015 and 16. So I think that's it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. And I'm sure you'll, once you review some of the documents, you'll have additional questions on the 10th.
May I?
Yes.
I have a question on this debt issue. Would you explain to me, Mr. DeMars, how this works? I'm looking at the debt.
Which page are you on?
I'm sorry, the direct and overlapping debt.
Sure.
Section there. And tell me where these, how these liens sit. Like, where does the Metropolitan Water District lien sit? Because do they have a lien on the property, or how does that work?
Well, they issue general obligation bonds for all the infrastructure that's associated with distributing the water to South County, as
right.
well as MODOC and all the public agencies in the county. And they've issued, you know, in 15-16, they still have $100 million that is still outstanding associated with that particular debt. And then as you go to the right, what we do then is just figure out what's attributable to the parcels that are within the CFD itself. And that's would be that that $8,000 that's associated with the CFD parcels. And the same goes for the Capo Unified, the same type of analysis.
Well, are these debts with the school district and the water districts, are they, it's not a lien on the property, is it?
Well, it, well, it's a,
I mean, they're bonds.
It's general obligation bond.
A general obligation.
Right? So it's depending on what the debt service is, it's assessed every year and put on the tax roll for collection. So it's part of the property tax.
So it's part of the property tax.
Correct.
And within the 1.8 or 2%.
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
All right. I got that. I have one other comment, and this is an old issue on Melrose's that we've been through before, and. Will your prospectus disclose the financial balance sheet of the landowner that's responsible for the Melrose before they're sold to somebody else?
No.
Okay, well, we've been through this before
right.
in Ladera, and it's occurred to PFAC before that since the unsold property is the tax or the bonds or the liability of the master developer or the owner of the land, when it's appropriate to show that they have the financial resources to pay it until the land is sold. Now, we've been through that before, and Ladera did provide the financial information before. I remember very distinctly they did.
They have provided me their financials as of June 30. They provided it to me as the financial advisor.
Well, but what I'm suggesting is it should be presented to PFAC and the Board of Supervisors, too. That's the moan I'm talking about.
Right.
That's what we've been through before. And interestingly, I remember in the Irvine Company, in the Newport Coast mm-hmm. issue, they refused to do it, and so instead what they did, they just bought the bonds back themselves.
Right.
they didn't want to. But at any rate, they did provide it to PFAC and to the Board of Supervisors in Ladera. And it just seems to me appropriate that since they're the obligation on the bonds, that the public should know about it.
I thought I was the rebel rouser.
No, that's...
This is Mr. Hammond's ongoing...
Yeah. Yeah. We've been through this before, Tom, I believe.
Right.
Yeah.
As of right now, I'm trying to find a page in the...
Got an excellent point.
POS, that the ranch actually is responsible for very little of the special tax associated with the CFD at this point because of the land sales that have already occurred
right.
to the merchant builders. And all the merchant builders are less than except for one, is less than 20% of the overall obligation. And there's been a test within that anything 20% or less as an obligated party, they're not an obligated party to disclose. And as a number of the builders, in fact, are publicly held companies, so all their information, financial information, is available on,
yeah, I understand,
on their individual websites. And the ranch, being a privately held entity, has been reluctant to provide that information.
Except they did.
Pardon me?
Except they did.
To people. On the Laderas.
Yeah, they did.
Do they do it separately?
No. We
because we didn't
it.
Disclose it in any of the prior OSs.
They did to us, and I can't dig it out. But the issue came up, and we said, you know, who's responsible for paying this Melrose debt until the property is sold, on the unsold portion, and wouldn't you need some financial information to see who's behind it? Because I'm looking here at the ownership, RMV Community Development and DMV Ladera. I mean, are these well-capitalized companies, or are they just operating companies with no account?
I understand the question, and based on the information that they provided to me, yes, they are. They have the financial resources to complete the development. And at this point, with the land sales that have occurred in the fall, with all the merchant builders, their portion of the taxes levied for this coming year, 15-16, is 8% of the total. So it's about $381,000 total that they would have to pay, that the ranch would have to pay on the CFD tax.
Well, okay, I'm not sure I understood. The CFD tax, the portion of the land that's not sold to the merchant builders or to anybody else at this point, or the school districts or anything else, how much land do they own?
It's approximately 10 acres out of the 317. And the obligation is about 8% of what the special tax levy is that went on the rolls for 15-16.
8% would be 80 million, or
oh, just for the portion of this year's tax.
Of this year's tax,
which is about $380,000
per year.
Per year.
Per year.
For this year.
Yeah, per year. So again.
For this year.
So again, I don't know about my colleagues on PFAC or the board thinks, but. Just seems to me that there is an ongoing liability to this group, these three entities, to pay that $380,000 tax every year, and shouldn't we see that they have the financial resources to do it? That's my point.
Madam.
Thank you, Chair Hughes. I had a similar question. It was a little different. Mine was coming from the LLC side because they are all limited liability companies, which sort of ties exactly in with Mr. Hammond is, you know, what happens if, you know, this next 6 months the real estate market drops out? And you did answer a lot of them. They have been sold, so it does appear that certainly now that risk is diversified. And I think it would be helpful to have a chart that identifies that, you know, what the code section is. It says if it's under 20%, the information, and maybe what information is available, because it is, you know, it is a lot of money. I was just looking at, you know, the special taxes are to be levied starting this year. So on the tax bill that we'll be mailing out in early October, and I don't see the auditor controller here, but I know we're going in early October, we're going to the board in early September, it will have a tax assessment on it. And so whoever, you know, owns that property as of, you know, obviously January 1st, but if there were subsequent sales, we'll try to get them to that, you know, seller that was the sale, will be responsible for pay that. And if the market does go down, then you have that nut every year until, you know, sales do occur.
Right.
So that LLC, you know, what is behind those LLCs? Does each company have one that's more of a, you know, a not a shell, but, you know, what assets do they have? And is it something that if it had been significant, which it sounds like it's much less because of the diversification in the land sales, is there a line of credit we should have as collateral? Or is there something that you should look at as security to make sure that we as the county are protected because we're collecting this from the landowner? And of course, I guess at some point we would foreclose on the property and take over the property, which would be the other option. So we would add all the fees on it, and then we would sell the property in 5 years. So I guess that's the...
Accelerated foreclosure proceeding that,
right,
that the county could go through if taxes are paid.
Well, but we've been, I've been sitting here for 17 years, and we did go through the period when we did have Melrose defaults in the state of California. And that was, they weren't major, but nevertheless, there were a few of them that were out there. And so it raised everybody's eyebrows about this issue, because the master builders didn't sell the property, and they didn't have enough money to pay the Melrose.
Right.
So, and that puts the other owners who already bought their property in bad shape, because 10% in this case is of development is not paid for. When they provided the Ladera financing before, mm-hmm, and I forgot the name of the entity.
It was DMB Ladera.
It was DMB. Well, it was astounding how strong they were. So, I mean, it was very incredibly successful project. I know,
right,
that. So I just bring that up for my colleagues to share and decide on. But I it seems to me that's not an unreasonable request for them to provide the information, because LLCs by their nature may or may not have any money in them and no liability.
Understand. So I think what we'll do is we will convey the committee's message to the ranch,
yeah,
and have them propose a solution.
Because we'd like to see this expedited. You have a very tight time schedule.
Well, when you come back with the deal, I mean, your schedule here on September 10th, or when, right, you're asking for approval, you can do it then.
Okay.
That's, yeah, what you were suggesting, I would hope.
Yeah, sure. And if they don't want to do it, then we got to scratch our heads and see what we want to do.
Okay.
Or approve it and tell the Board of Supervisors that we're going blind here on financial statements. Let them decide.
Okay.
Probably not the best outcome.
Well, the best outcome is to have the numbers. And I would be willing to bet that the ranch would do that, or these entities would do it.
Right, or something that would be that collateral that they have if not providing financials, because there's a couple of ways you can look at that without actually having to provide information. We're looking to make sure that the funds are paid. I mean, I think that's our concern, is we want to make sure that those funds are paid.
Understood. We will bring the message.
Okay.
Chair Youssef, if I might.
Yes.
Just for some clarification, probably everybody else understands this but me, but the value to ratio, or the bond to value ratio of 3-1, can you elaborate? What does that mean? The value of the property is 3 times greater than the bond, or?
Correct.
Okay.
So if you're issuing $10 million in bonds, you need $30 million in value in the land to be able to make the test.
Got it. Just wanted to be clear on that.
Yep.
Any further questions? Thank you.
No, I just I think that this project is it's good for the community. It's good for Orange County. It's a quality enterprise, and I think that I'm certainly an advocate of everything they're doing, notwithstanding my little request. but I think it's a wonderful asset, and I think the communities of Mission Viejo and Ladera have turned out very well.
I think before we leave, we follow up on the previous conversation. We will, I guess we've moved this agenda item to next time, or in September, to discuss the policies and procedures and the purpose of PFAC. But I happen to have it in front of me, what our procedures are and the responsibility of the requesting party bringing forward. One of those, following up with Member Hammond's comments, is that you're to bring us a description of the source of funds for repayment, a description of the potential risk factors, which again, he's talking the liquidity ratios, a description of credit enhancement, et cetera. And they're all along the lines seeking the security for the county. So I think that's going to give us some clearer direction on why he's asking for that and what we must have, because those are under, if you can get those from our county council, I'm sure you have them, but refresh them. Those are in the rules that it is your responsibility to give to us. So we'd have a hard time saying, well, we're going to give you a waiver on that when it's actually the policies that we're under. So
I have, and most of that will be covered in the documents that are that'll be agendized.
I just have one more question on the I doubt that the ranch or any of these entities are the ones that are going to develop the affordable housing. They'll probably sell it to one of the affordable housing groups. Is that correct? Would you guess that, Tom, to be the case?
Through the chair, Mr. Hammond, the property affordable housing parcel is provided to the county to as part of the master development agreement, so that they were to provide parcels, so there will probably be parcels in other phases as well, and that the county housing authority will work with a nonprofit developer,
right,
who will come in to develop that.
Yeah, that was my question, I guess.
Yes.
And we have not had an affordable housing bond deal in years.
It's 2012, right? I believe.
Is that right? And so is it likely that we'll have an... Is anybody using those anymore, Tom?
No.
The county bond? Apparently not. We haven't seen them in years. So we don't get a bite at what the terms of the affordable period or term is at that time, unless we issue the bonds for the housing.
Right.
Okay.
Hence the request to find out what is the general understanding of what's required.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Thank you. Excellent. That leaves us to the next item on the agenda. That would be the training session. We can always learn. And by the way, because we are just scouring over this, one of the responsibilities of financing staff is to train us, I see.
Yes, happy to do so.
And in fulfillment of that obligation, who do we have here today?
I'd like to invite Lyle Rosso, Assistant County Procurement Officer, to provide a session on the request for proposal process and evaluation committee process. We've had, you know, several RFPs and several lively discussions this past year. So we thought it would be a great idea just to go have the procurement professional from the county just give an overview of the county's policies and then drill down into the RFP process and the evaluation committee process as is relevant to the work here of the Public Financing Advisory Committee.
Good afternoon, members of the PFAC committee. My name is Lyle Rosso. I'm from the County Procurement Office, and provided to you as a binder, and in that binder is a copy of this presentation, an excerpt from the county's contract policy manual related to the RFP process. And then the final one is actually navigating the RFP request for proposals process. You can see there's quite an extensive amount of information in there.
Some light reading.
Yeah, enjoyable reading. But that's the business I'm in. And so for the nature of this presentation, I'm going to be hitting the high points because clearly I would not be able to cover all this information and probably keep you all awake at the same time. So what I'll do is I'll go ahead and go through the PowerPoint, and if you have questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Some of the things I'll cover is the active policy, then the roles and responsibilities, the evaluation committee process, and then we'll talk about confidentiality and public record when things aren't public record, when they are, and then we'll go through the questions. I've also provided a link for those of you that have just are interested in even more to the actual full County of Orange contract policy manual there as well. So the request for proposals process is utilized when the county's either not certain what they want to acquire or they need the industry to propose them a method in which to acquire goods or services, or they need a specific type of expertise. And part of that is covered on this slide right here, and I kind of italicized item C, availability, expertise, and quality override price. And that's really kind of the key of the proposal is you're looking at best value, just something other than cost that could be staffing expertise. Otherwise, bidders will have the opportunity to submit proposals. So the county goes ahead and puts together its request for proposals. They work together to formulate a scope of work or what their desired outcome is. They will go ahead and advertise that on the street, and then the folks that are interested in responding to that proposal will go ahead and submit a proposal prescribing the method or solution or perhaps the staffing expertise necessary to provide the county with the goods or services or deliverables that are needed. So that's just a broad overview on the RFP process. The advantages of an RFP is, you know, the innovation and best value, because it's not strictly based on cost. Typically, cost-based bids are for well-defined services or goods. So computers such as that with RFPs are usually more complicated. And since they're more complicated, some of the disadvantages is a longer or more complicated process due to the evaluation and the interaction than a cost-based bid. It is also a subjective process. Being a subjective process, since you have an evaluation panel evaluating that, protests can occur. And I'll just pause briefly on the protest process. There are two opportunities for proposers to protest. The first opportunity is when that proposal is released. Remember, the county went ahead and formed the proposal. We sent it out to the community. A proposer, or actually anyone, can go ahead and protest that. They might feel maybe the requirements are unfairly restrictive. There may be some other reasons, but that individual has the opportunity to protest that those specifications or that RFP up to 5 days prior to it closing. The second opportunity for protest would be they have 5 days after the notice of intent to award. I'll talk about that a little bit later in the presentation, but essentially that's at the end of the process after it's been evaluated and the county has determined that they are going to go ahead and intend to award to someone. At that point, it becomes public record. Then they'll have 5 days from there if they don't, they wish to protest. Okay.
A quick question on that, if I might, Lyle, is that 5 days after it's actually approved by, say, the Board of Supervisors, so it's the final approval process, or is it the interim approval process?
No, that's a great question. No, essentially, the protest period clock starts. So I'll just fast forward. The proposal was released. Mm-hmm. Proposals were received. Mm-hmm. Proposals were evaluated mm-hmm. individually, you know, ranked and scored. Mm-hmm. The evaluation committee went ahead and got together in their mm-hmm. Unified understanding meeting, kind of talked the proposals, got your final tally. You have your, let's say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Mm-hmm. You, as the evaluation panel, decide, hey, we wish to move forward. We have a notice of intent to award a contract to number one. The contract hasn't been finalized yet, but that's that notice, meaning the scoring process is over. The decision has been made as far as from a recommendation standpoint. So it hasn't gone to the Board of Supervisors yet. It's at that point that the county releases a notice of intent to award to those participants of that proposal. And that's your start of the clock, of the 5 day clock. So unfortunately, not everybody gets to win. So the proposers that are not being selected would receive that notice of intent to award. And if they submit within that time for a protest, they're required to go ahead and state the reason their protest, you know, provide facts-based reasoning behind that and what type of remedy they would like to see as part of that protest to try to resolve it. So thank you for the question there. So it's, once again, very important that we maintain a fair, competitive, and transparent process, regardless of a cost-based bid or RFP. So with that being said, we start talking about roles and responsibilities. And the county has deputized purchasing agents, and they are technically the shepherd of the entire RFP process. They're the ones that will formulate terms and conditions. And it might be in conjunction with county council or whatever expertise they need, or perhaps risk, as appropriate. They develop that RFP along with the scope of work with the people that are initiating and requesting that RFP. They're also the liaison between the proposers and the eval committee. It's really important there has to be separation and no communication between the evaluation committee members and the proposers. Once again, we need a fair, competitive, transparent process, and it's not good if communications are happening at all different places and with different people. And so those are all channeled through that deputy purchasing agent. And then on that note, there is also the evaluation committee is they'll be required to understand and sign a conflict of interest form. And that is to ensure that there's no personal or professional conflicts. That time, I had mentioned just a brief overview of the proposals, you know, in the process. I'll just revisit that briefly. Proposals are requested, it come in. The deputized purchasing agent or DPA will review those for responsiveness. He or she will call a meeting of that evaluation panel. They will come in. He or she will then go ahead and have a list of, you know, who responded to the RFP and get that evaluation panel members to be able to look at the names of those companies on there, see if folks have perhaps a conflict. The eval panel members will sign that conflict of interest form. And obviously, if they do have a conflict, they just need to go ahead and disclose that at that time. And that may need to be run through county council to see if that conflict of interest potentially will prohibit them from participating. After you get through the conflict of interest, you sign that. The evaluation panel then has all the proposals distributed to them by the DPA. It's each individual panel member's responsibility to go ahead and thoroughly read, understand, and then they individually score those proposals. And then you guys will meet as a group, the evaluation panel, to discuss and compile scores to find out who ranked the highest. It's really critical to maintain confidentiality of all the proposal information. As I mentioned, it does not become a public record until after that notice of intent to award letter or notification is released. So it is crucial because, you know, once those scorings and rankings come in, that top-ranked vendor, the DPA, along with whoever else may be appropriate for, like, the negotiations process, it's really important that the folks, the other proposers, don't know who proposed or the details of the proposal, because that can jeopardize our negotiations position. So,
but do the vendors get copies of the evaluations?
None of that is public record until such time that notice of intent to award is released. After the notice of intent to award is released, that becomes a public record. The proposal responses, the procurement file. When the evaluation panel members score individually, they have those individual scoring sheets. The panel will get together and have that unified understanding meeting. And from there, they'll do the final tally. And then you'll have a ranking. So you'll have a memorandum of recommendation that recommends we go with the highest ranked proposer, ABC Company. And underneath that will be each individual evaluation panel member's individual scoring sheets, their final scoring sheets. The names are not on these scoring sheets of the evaluation panel members. Those are redacted, or panel members are given numbers.
So the vendors see the ratings?
Correct.
They just don't know who rated them?
Correct.
All right.
Yeah, so there's that transparency there. So another important point, and I put important points in red, is that costs should not be scored individually on each evaluation. That's typically reserved for the evaluation committee chairperson. And that chairperson will sometimes, if they need to bring in a subject matter expert to go ahead and evaluate cost or total cost of ownership or something along those lines, that may be necessary as well. But that's not individually scored by the scoring members. In the handout here, each of these steps are discussed a little more extensively. I'm once again just hitting the high points, okay?
And I might have, through the chair, on the cost, I think that if I recall, because I've been doing a lot of RFPs also, there's three ways you can actually score. And, you know, depending on which way you use, just a thought to procurement, you know, I think at least one of the ways, even if there's a large discrepancy in price, the way it's calculated, it really doesn't have much variability. So it's a little harder. So I would maybe ask you guys to look at that area, because certainly if you want to have it be an objective, if someone's getting a 5 for the top and then someone's getting a 4.9 and a 4.8, when you look at those in relationship to other scores, I mean, it becomes so minuscule. It's just, it just drops off the mat, even though there could be some fairly significant differences in some of the pricing. I'm not, probably not PFAC as much, but I know in some of the ones, so we've tried to look at some of the other cost methods, and, you know, there is quite a bit of variability depending on which cost method. So it would be nice for procurement to perhaps look at those and maybe make some recommendations on types of contracts maybe they should be utilized for, because I did notice a quite variation depending on what you pick, and you want it to be very valid and objectable and enforceable. And I know we have the three methods, but they come up with slightly different ratings depending on how you use them.
Okay, thank you for that. And you are correct. There are three different methods mentioned in this the process here that's before you. And that's typically something that would want to be worked out, you know, at the outset of the RFP process. It's kind of look at what would be the most reasonable means to evaluate cost on based on those three different means of doing so. And that leads me to another thing within the proposals themselves. When proposals are released, it's disclosed to those proposers what evaluation criteria will be used. And you had mentioned cost, which is typically one of them. But since this is a proposals process, it's not just based on cost. So there can be the technical approach of the proposal, staffing or staffing expertise, various criteria that's relevant to the type of result you're looking to get from that proposal, whether it's a service or something specialized. Understand the evaluation rules. This is just an evaluation committee, just the understand the rules and process, and I put reference your binder because it's a lot of reading. And to establish a evaluation committee chairperson, so these are just some of the steps. Thoroughly read the proposals, score them individually. So as that process goes through and you've individually scored the proposals, next you're going to have that unified understanding meeting. This is where you really kind of discuss the proposals and you finalize your scoring. And here's why. The purpose of having an evaluation panel is you have different folks with different backgrounds. They catch different things. You have multiple people reading the same document. And they're able to pick up through their expertise or reading, pick up certain aspects of the proposal and score those individually. Part of the unified understanding is what you don't want to have is someone gave someone a 1 and someone gave someone a 5, you know, in a range of 0 to 5. So in that unified understanding meeting, you really want to kind of talk to that person that gave the 1 and the person that gave a 5 and find out, well, why did you give them a 1? Why did you give them a 5? What relevant facts were those scores based on? And that's so that way, as a panel, you can all meet, find out the facts, and then you can look at the scoring to see what's appropriate. Scores may be adjusted during this time, and sometimes they're not. So it's just up to the DPA and the evaluation committee chairperson to go ahead and work through that meeting. After that's done, you may have some interviews or presentations, and I put if applicable, because those have to be disclosed in the RFP, especially if there's any type of presentation that was going to be scored on. There needs to be criteria to that. There could also be interviews or things necessary for when there's clarification points. So you're reading these proposals, you're kind of understanding most all the aspects, but you have a few nagging issues that you weren't sure or didn't seem very clear. You would just want to document those things, bring those to that deputy purchasing agent. Since they're the liaison, they can go ahead and either collect those answers or information for you, or if they need to, they can bring that proposer in to respond to that. Best and final offers, that's if necessary. Once again, this is all covered in the material. I'm just touching bases on that. That's if it's necessary. If you have a clear cut top ranked firm, fine. If you have some that are maybe really neck and neck together, you may want to look at that and see whether or not it's advantageous to do a best and final offer. I talked about the memorandum of recommendation with the individual scoring sheets attached. And so we'll just jump really quickly to the confidentiality and public records. So all of this information is not public information until that notice of intent to award goes out. So it's really crucial that, you know, with discussions or anything else, we don't have discussions with the proposers or, you know, private and public, you know, areas. We can't disclose, you know, pricing or even you know, who responded to the RFP. Once again, we're trying to safeguard our abilities to negotiate and then also not violate any of the process in that. So I think that is really about it. Is there any questions that I can respond to?
I have a question for you. Having heard all of this, do you think it's a good idea or a bad idea to have a PFAC member on this evaluating committee?
That's a good question. Obviously, your PFAC committee members are here because your level of knowledge and expertise, and so I think that's a benefit. I would check with what rules apply to you regarding, you know, the ability to actually have, you know, a vote or a say, and that there may be restrictions to that. So if you're on an evaluation panel, and I mean, this may be a legal question, I don't want to answer because I'm not an attorney. However, as an eval panel member, you are individually scoring proposals and are a part of a group that ultimately is releasing a memorandum of recommendations. So I think it's good to have subject matter experts on it. I'm not certain whether or not PFAC folks can could or should be on there, and that's
so you don't have an opinion?
No, I do. I think it's good. It's just as long as it's they're able to participate, I think there's value to that. And value to having an evaluation panel that has the background and expertise that can properly evaluate a proposal.
Well, I don't mean to become esoteric about this, but
okay.
It seems to me that if you have a PFAC member on the evaluation team and you go through the discussions of you like this bank or you don't like this, and there are biases and prejudices in picking underwriters and law firms, and I mean, we all know that.
Sure.
And then that PFAC member comes back to this committee and has input, and we're supposed to do an up or down vote on what the public finance department wants us to do. That's what Angie wrote. That's essentially what we're supposed to do. And it seems to me if that PFAC member has some privy information because of the evaluation process, that they're not acting objectively to the PFAC.
That's a situation that could occur. I can't really advise you on that. The whole purpose of an evaluation panel is to get all those individuals to score and then to get that full tally together. If that notice of intent award hasn't been released, then that individual on the PFAC committee that's serving on that panel could not share that information with the rest because it's confidential.
Exercising the prerogative of the chair to jump in here, first of all, I disagree that we can only up or down, because at page 8 of the policies, which we have been poring over lately, we have three things we can do, which is to approve, modify, or deny. But what I would be interested in as a follow-up, we have the comment that it would be a good thing, but a comment that county council had before is, what are the legalistic implications if a PFAC member were to sit on the at the committee and then come back to PFAC? Because that, I think, we need to have more background on.
Yeah, it seems to me that I can see a dilemma here, because if there's a controversy on the evaluation committee and the PFAC member comes back and shares that controversy, is that appropriate? Probably not.
No, it's not. That's all of the, you know, the conversations and the activities of the evaluation panel are supposed to be between that panel alone. So
could county council give us in the appropriate time some guidance on the issue of a PFAC member sitting on these committees, and does it cause a limitation or a problem, or where we're at? Would that be possible?
Yes, I'd be happy to provide you a confidential memo.
And then we could take that discussion from.
No, it's a dilemma. It's a dilemma, I think, and I guess we should think about it. I mean, it's
right. No, I'd like to see it agendized after we've had a chance to receive county council's information. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair Hughes. I think the other item that I know when I read through the voluminous manual is that they do recommend in the contract purchase manual, the CPM, that you look at a committee that may have even a public member on it and not be just within the, you're really looking for some diversity so you can actually get some input. So that might tie a little bit that maybe it should be a different public member versus someone on the PFAC. But I think that the manual does talk about it. Maybe, Lyle, if you could explain a little bit more of that aspect, that might be helpful for us.
Yeah, correct. The formation of an evaluation panel is you want an odd number of folks on that, minimum three, preferably five. And typically, and this in the County Board of Supervisors has encouraged this as well, is you want to have, obviously, subject matter experts, but then also an outside member of the public or someone else to provide that balance from that for evaluating this. So, as Sherry brought up, that might be a solution as opposed to having a PFAC, but having someone else, maybe that is a member of the outside public, perform on the evaluation panel that may have some of that subject matter expertise and background. One final thing that I wanted to mention too is once that process has been completed, so it's been evaluated, you've got your top ranked individual and things are going great, contract gets negotiated and executed. If that service contract is less than $100,000 per year, then the DPA has the authority to go ahead and issue that contract. Should that contract exceed $100,000 per year, then the authority is with the Board of Supervisors to review and approve that contract. And I'm just sharing that in there from a time and planning perspective for that. Is there any other questions?
I did have one other question, just on the, you know, the best and final offer, kind of that cost question. And part of it goes back to those formulas that are used. I know at PFAC we've had a couple where when you round them, even though their prices were different, they came up with the same rating because of rounding, where one clearly had a higher price than another. And, you know, do you use... I mean, we deal with a lot of professionals where we have a base fee and then they've got expenses that are estimated and you've got other fees. You know, I'm assuming my thought in, you know, when I would ask questions on some of them, that they would include really everything. You should really base your cost on everything. But I am interested in, you know, how that aspect works because sometimes it becomes, I mean, it can be a, almost a 10% difference, but because you're using the formula that has it, even though you say cost is 25% or 30%, when you use the formula, it becomes a very, very small difference. So it's hard to say that it's that 25%. And when would you be able to, if any, in that best and final offer, is that something that if the pricing, you know, does PFAC really need to go back to the financing staff to say, we really expect you to sharpen the pencil here, because we've talked about, you know, keeping those prices low, understanding that it's not everything, but in looking at it, because that cost factor, the way it's calculated, it doesn't really seem to make a lot of difference. And so, you know, perhaps you could say, when would you negotiate it? Is it after it would be approved by PFAC or after the board? Is that when final negotiations take place where you could do that? Or how does that relate to the, you know, in the CPM and the manual?
Well, how best and finals work in relation to that is that's going to happen before any contract is executed.
Uh-huh.
And a contract wouldn't be executed unless the DPA has the authority or it's been board approved. So I just wanted to clarify that first. In relation to the best and final offer, it doesn't necessarily only have to be, you know, price. There can be certain aspects where you can have them sharpen the pencil on, you know, approach, certain aspects of the proposal you'd like further detailing on. Best and finals usually have two really closely ranked mm-hmm. Firms, and you know, there could be more, but typically it's usually a couple, and it's really neck and neck, and you're asking them to sharpen up the pencil to do a best and finals, which means they submit another proposal that they've sharpened the pencil on gets evaluated through the same process as the original one. So that's additional time and effort. Mm-hmm. And then from there, once that's done, then it's ranked and scored, just like before, and then somebody wins. One of those two gives you their best and final offer that you want to select. Now, when it comes to the negotiations part, you know, they give you that proposal. You can still, through the DPA, find points in that proposal that the county may wish to negotiate, whether that's pricing or other aspects, service levels, responses, reports, any of those types of deliverables that you want. Those are within the county's rights to do that. You do that prior to finalizing the contract, because you have to work those details out before you can memorialize that in an enforceable contract document.
Right. So just a follow-up, because if it's already gone to the board and been approved, there's no incentive for someone to drop any prices at that point. So is that before that final approval? Because at that point you lose basically your leverage if you had any. So those are actually before it goes for that final approval?
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
You would negotiate all of the terms, conditions, pricing, everything that the county would desire in that contract, memorialize that in a contract document, have that vendor sign, which means they agree to that.
Okay.
And then you take that vendor side. The county doesn't sign that yet. If it's over $100,000, we take that, agendize that for the Board of Supervisors if their authority is needed. Once they approve it, then we can sign it, and that formalizes the document. And the services can start.
I have one last. Can I pester you one more thing? I want to tell a story. There used to be a time here in the county, in PFAC, less than 18 years ago, but more than 15 years ago. But at any rate, there were certain people that were persona non grata in the county, Merrill Lynch for one, because, you know, they were part of the bad guys in a bankruptcy, and there was all kinds of prejudices and people dislikes and so on and so forth. What happens if, now here's my question, what happens if your evaluation committee comes up with your process and you say, here's the best deal, and you take it to Suzanne Lester and she says, I hate those underwriters, they did a terrible job in the last deal we do, I don't want to do it. What happens then?
Well, the memorandum of recommendation, which is after everyone tallies the scores, so regardless of what vendor that may or may not be, or what history they may or may not have with the county, that's the evaluation panel's recommendation, and that's presented to the DPA. And so the DPA typically will concur with that unless they have some real known performance issue. I'm talking in recent, so let's say perhaps the incumbent has responded to the proposal and maybe there's been some performance issues
that don't show up in the evaluation process.
Right, that was information or news that the evaluation panel did not have
right
at the time that they scored. But that would be, that's that shepherding process that the DPA would be doing with the evaluation panel. They come back with a recommendation. If there is a concern with that vendor, then that DPA, you know, or Suzanne would be working with the eval panel to say why that she or he wouldn't concur with that recommendation, the DPA, why she or he wouldn't concur with that.
So it gets negotiated back and forth with you being the shepherd, so to speak. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, it's not very often that a DPA will overturn a
Well, it used to happen a lot. It used to happen a lot in the counties.
So if I might interrupt, I have a question, Lyle. If there's an evaluation panel formed and we have proposals, and I am a DPA now, I just got my certification, and
congratulations.
Thank you. And I know, because I'm the director of public finance, that I have a current or recent past performance issue with one of the vendors. When is the appropriate time for me to share the county's experience? Is it before they evaluate, or do I wait and see how the evaluation turns out and then give my input after the evaluation?
If the county is experiencing non-performance or unsatisfactory performance from a vendor, that should be documented and therefore kept in the file. And since it's in the file, it's a public record. Therefore, you sharing that information with the evaluation panel would not be you going out of your way with an opinion against it. You're just stating the facts that I know evaluation panel, you're reviewing these various proposals. I just want to shed light that at this current time, this firm has a contract with the county. They've perhaps performed satisfactorily in year one and two. We're currently in year three, whatever the case may be. Here's some of the things we're working out. And if you just stay to the facts of what the performance issues are and how they're being handled and whether the vendor has responded and come back up to satisfactory performance or if we're still in the process. That's information that's going to help the evaluation panel know how the performance is going on with that specific one. That kind of ties in with references and different other information that can be looked at as part of the proposal evaluation process.
Well, that leads us to the next step that this kind of started, that is, let's assume it's not Suzanne Luster who says, you know, I've got a concern here, but they're in front of us after the panel has voted. What powers do we have to say, you know, hey, we don't like the way you price this or whatever it is? And because we've actually had people stand here and say, well, you know, we're going to do something different. Is that appropriate?
Really, the negotiations, whether it's for price or desired outcomes, that should be done during the negotiations process. Part of really what the critical component of the RFP process is really developing a scope of work or services that really addresses what the county wants or needs, what the desired outcomes are, the deliverables, those types of things. If that can be properly captured and put into that RFP, then the hope is you're not going to have someone standing here in front of you that needs further negotiations to having additional services or pricing discounts done from this type of venue. It really should be done at the part where the evaluation happened and negotiations occurred between the DPA evaluation and the negotiations team. So,
Mr. Rodecker?
Agreed. Should and usually usually is, but on occasion there is an opportunity when we've seen the evaluation, we've seen all the facts, and they're really very close, and we see one of the vendors is here and the other isn't, or they're both here, but we kind of like one, but their price is a little higher, and if we say, hey, if you can come down 10%, that's the deciding factor for us, and that saves the county money, and it gets the vendor that we want, and it gets it at the price we want. And I'm not saying that we should try to renegotiate every person that walks up here, but on the rare occasions where that is the only issue, and that's the only difference between what would otherwise be our first choice, can we ask them at the podium, can you come down 10%, or is that prohibited?
Angie says no.
I don't think you can do that, and that's
a good thing I can't be fired from this position.
and I wouldn't be the person to do that, so no, it wouldn't be appropriate to do that, and what we don't want to have is
even though we've done it mistakenly.
Mistakenly.
Mistakenly, we've done it.
With the consent of all concerned. In a full and open forum, right?
Right.
Without looking back, but only moving forward, yes, we would not want that to happen because we don't want to have a situation where it may appear that we're auctioneering the contractor services. Really, if we're looking for pricing or value, that really needs to be driven during the negotiations, and that's sometimes what best and final offers purposes are.
Except when Ms. Daftrey, when you're giving us our memo, the policies do say that we can, in addition to up or down, modify. And it would seem to me that modifying might go in this category of asking them to modify. Would you define for us when you come back to us what that could mean? Get my point?
Yeah, it's a little, you go back.
I don't think the one is modifying.
Well, that's what I'm asking, the rules say that we're given, we can approve, deny, or modify.
Yeah.
I'd like to know what modify means. If you can't you're telling us we can't. I don't think that's quite. Let's see if we can get a little more clarification.
And adding to that point, I think that your memo, while it was very good, it does sort of contradict itself on that issue a little bit. On one hand, it says you can modify, and then further on, you go down to say you can't change the deal because that is a bad faith and it's unfair to other vendors. So it was a little confusing to me. I went back and forth on that issue. So
I think we just need further clarification, and we look at it in a different light.
Yeah.
County Council, I think, had a certain purpose, and we've expanded the purposes so that we can get clarification for the PFAT committee. That's a very healthy discussion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for jumping in on it.
No problem.
And I do have one follow-up question,
yes,
if I might. And I very much appreciate your coming, because it's good to have you guys out, I think, going through. But one of the things I'm thinking of is when staff comes to us then with the RFPs, the committee has met, they've got their recommendation. So between that recommendation, you're telling me that they can then take that top person and further negotiate before something comes to us. So they've got their top winner there, and say there is a price discrepancy, but it's not as evident because they're using the method that has the 5, the 4.9, the 4.8, it doesn't. Can they, prior to bringing it here to us, then say, to that top person something about further negotiations at that point? So when it comes to us, they can indicate what we've done is we've gone through the evaluation. We've also done further negotiations. We feel this is, and maybe it has to be that best and final, if that's how the process has to work, that you take those top two. And I think that has to be in the RFP. And again, it becomes a little more formal. You can't take maybe the, I don't know if you can take the top two or, what process it has to go through. And I think part of it is this darn cost, that the calculation is just not very, it's not very helpful, so that we aren't doing things that are in violation, but we are getting, we are the public, you have public members here, and that cost is a big factor because it is important, especially when you see large discrepancies that, you have two very top firms and you see a fairly wide discrepancy in their services, and staff is saying, well, either would be okay, but this is the top person that, we could work with any of these, but this would be the one. And obviously the one is a lot less priced. How do you reconcile that, fiduciary of those public funds? And I know the RFP process is supposed to process that, but again, it's that cost piece that seems a little bit odd sometimes.
Yes, and I see cost is definitely a strong factor in this. When the evaluation...
Good companies, every one of the companies that gets on our list, generally we know is qualified. I think we do a two-state process, so most of them are actually qualified. So I don't remember if we do the invitation to bid first, and then we basically narrow it down. So we've already screened out really all the people that couldn't do the business, generally. Now, they have expertise, and different ones have certain expertise, but we've gone through where you're just not getting someone who's low-cutting the price and coming in. You've got very high-quality firms that are coming in here, all high reputation with good references.
Okay, well, the process is, and I'll just explain it once again, is that the evaluation committee goes through and scores and ranks those proposals, gets a memorandum of recommendation, gets it to the deputized purchasing agent. They have the top-ranked firm. They can work with that next step is they're going to go ahead and talk about commencing negotiations with that. Okay. So that's going to happen. If that notice of intent to award has not been released yet, typically negotiations happens because you want to, before you get that notice of intent to award, you want to first find out whether or not that top-ranked firm is going to negotiate and you can arrive at a contract with them. So
that would be the case where we would direct staff to say, make sure that last piece before it comes, you've looked at some of these criteria. So when it comes, they've already gone through the DPA along with that committee and those sort of those final negotiations with that for the intent to proceed is gone out.
If the evaluation panel has a clear direction of what the goals and objectives of this committee is regarding the price or other outcomes that are, have been put in the proposal, at the end of the day, they're ranking that based on the criteria in the proposal, the cost being one of those, and in one of those three fashions that cost is measured.
Right.
After that time, That top-ranked one, that's when negotiations happen. That's when that price goes.
Okay, great, thank you.
Yeah.
May I suggest when we come back with the further information that you be invited back to be available if we have further discussions, because I think we do need some clarifications. This was an excellent overview, but we want to hone in on a couple of the procedural aspects, and we need a little more information. With that, do we have any further comments? Any questions from the public or any member of the panel? Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
Before you close, I won't be able to make the September 10th meeting. I'll be out of town from the 8th to the 15th. I don't know how relevant that is, but if you want me here, we'd have to move it up or back.
Thank you.
Ms. Lester, I know we've got the sheriff's thing, which we promised we would expedite under the circumstances. Can that be moved a week, or shall we leave it?
There is that one, Chair Hughes, and the CFD, which we're on a time schedule with the Board of Supervisors. So it would be difficult to move the meeting at this point.
Will you please we're going to miss you. But would you please make an effort to make sure we have a quorum and everybody is there?
Yes. We'll start checking right away.
I understand. No worries.
Okay.
We do have one more agenda item, but my understanding it's going to be continued to the next meeting.
Oh, I thought we had already done that.
If you'd like to announce it and then just...
we were going to... The agenda item is a verbal discussion of the third amended and restated County of Orange Board of Supervisors policies and procedures for consideration and approval of proposed public financings. Due to time and other reasons that we need more information, and to make sure that we have a full discussion, we'd like to continue that. Would like that continued, though, to a date that Mr. Roedecker will be here as well. And we do have a full agenda on that September 10th meeting. Why don't we put it at that meeting, skip a meeting and have it so he might be here?
Yes, the next meeting after that would be October 8th.
Okay.
Perfect.
If we can agendize that, and then we can have everybody there.
Okay, and would it be okay then for me to issue my opinions on the issues that were stated today for that October meeting?
Right.
Okay.
Because we'd like to look at that in the context of all of those, okay. And I'm sure you're, as you usually do, get it to us ahead of time so we can be prepared.
Okay.
Right, and the chair, I might just...
I have to go sue somebody.
Right. No problem. I may not be here the 8th. I've been asked to speak at our county treasurer's education conference, which I think is, I have that at 3 o'clock that day. So I'll check with staff on it.
Well, for that meeting after this next meeting, perhaps, Ms. Lester, you could coordinate to get a date that's acceptable to have a quorum here.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be the 8th. We can move.
It doesn't have to be. That one wouldn't need to be the 8th.
Okay, we'll take a look at that.
Thanks. Right, and see, Madam Treasurer's opinions are quite insightful, so we'd like to have her here. With that, then, we will only schedule the next meeting is scheduled, and we'll look into rescheduling the meeting after to effectuate a quorum and that all the principals are here. Is that appropriate?
Yes.
All right.
Move to adjourn?
Would you move to adjourn?
Move to adjourn.
Second.
Oh, I'll vote for that. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.